session, Judge Ross, Judge Schmidt, Judge Cleary, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning, and welcome to this panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals for the July 17, 2024 panel of cases. We have two cases on our oral argument calendar this morning, having lost a couple that I dropped off before today. The first matter on our calendar is, I'm going to try to pronounce this, correct me if I'm wrong, State of Minnesota versus Tuum. Tuum. All right.
I do Tuum.
So both of our, okay, I do Tuum. Thank you. Appellants counsel, you'll have 15 minutes for your argument, also 15 minutes for opposing counsel with an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal on behalf of the appellant. Please keep track of the timing restrictions. They're indicated in the podium. There's also a little button, if you're not familiar with it, in front of the lectern. It allows you to raise or lower it to match your height for your convenience. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, and you may proceed whenever you're ready.
It pleases the court. Counsel, my name is Davi Axelson. I represent the appellant Quadwo Adu Tuum. Mr. Adu Tuum's registration requirement should be removed because the state did not have probable cause to charge him with kidnapping based on the exact same conduct that constituted the deprivation of parental rights charges. The holding we are requesting is limited to situations where the state charges a parent with a kidnapping and the only underlying felony is deprivation of parental rights and no other independent crime. Deprivation of parental rights cannot satisfy the facilitate the commission of a felony element of kidnapping because it is not an independent crime and it has a similar taking and consent element to a kidnapping charge. State v. Larson and State v. Colvin both addressed a similar situation under the burglary statute. And in both cases found that that State v. Larson, where he was charged with trespassing as the underlying crime, and in Colvin, where he was charged with violation of an OFP, failed to be enough because of the violation of those offenses. Both just met the entry component of a burglary charge.
Counsel, it's a preliminary question I have here. As I understood it, the court's order at sentencing regarding registering was issued in August of 22, is that correct?
That sounds right.
And it was for the duration of probation, so it ends in a few weeks?
I don't know the answer to that. I do know that my client has finished his probation obligation.
Okay. All right.
But I thought the registration requirement is a 10-year time period.
It often is, except that as I read this, he was ordered to register immediately and maintain registration compliance for the duration of his probation.
Okay, I guess I'm not familiar with that component of the order. The focus in Colvin discussed how an OFP can be violated in multiple ways, but in the Colvin situation, the OFP violation was strictly limited to the entry in that case, and in a similar fashion that a kidnapping can be violated in multiple ways. But here, the kidnapping that the state charged, or in the amended complaint, was just based on the facilitation of the felony of deprivation of parental rights. And similar to Colvin, where the underlying felony just violated one component of the elements of burglary, here, the deprivation of parental rights has a similar violation of the elements of kidnapping because it involves both the taking and the lack of consent. Regarding the burglary charge in Colvin and Larson, there is an exception similar to the kidnapping that says that when a burglary is charged, there's an exception you can charge and convict on multiple offenses that are committed during the burglary, yet in neither Colvin or Larson, the court relied on that exception in order to extinguish the arguments made by Colvin or Larson, in the same way that this court should not rely on that exception under the kidnapping statute. And
counsel, your motions to dismiss at district court, as I understood it, were based on duplicity and double jeopardy, correct?
Duplicity and multiplicity, I believe.
Okay. All right. Are you confident that you preserved properly the issues you're arguing now before us?
I believe that both the first and second issues for sure are under that same guise. There hasn't been, you know, the state did make a waiver argument regarding something else, but has not challenged that we're making a new argument regarding the challenge to probable cause on appeal. So I don't think that issue would be before this court. Regarding their argument regarding waiver, I think that relates to they're saying that we should have resubmitted an argument at sentencing challenging the registration requirement. I think that's wrong because the probable cause challenge was preserved here. There is not a requirement that you have to reassert a probable cause challenge at sentencing. The registration statute actually specifically says that, let's see if I can find this in my notes. Under 243.166 subdivision 2, the court may not modify the person's duty to register in the pronounced sentence or disposition order. And I think once the judge has found probable cause, there wouldn't be an argument other than asking the judge to reconsider the earlier probable cause motion. And there wouldn't be an additional argument just because he was acquitted of the additional charges to ask to resubmit. I think that the preserved issue, it happens at the probable cause challenge, and that this court has authority under Lopez to determine if probable cause is lacking, and under Hokos, if probable cause is lacking, that the registration requirement wouldn't attach to Mr. Dutoum's convictions.
I don't want to take you too far afield of your argument, but just curious, you are suggesting, at least in your oral argument, that it's a matter of waiver that's not raised by the respondent is not before the court. I mean, don't we have an independent obligation to address the issue of whether an issue has been preserved, whether it's been challenged or not by the respondent?
Ultimately, this court can decide in any way how it sees fit, how it wants to proceed.
No, but
in
I mean,
this
it's
case.
A matter of procedure. We wouldn't, without briefing, reverse on an issue not raised, but I'm not sure that that's the same as so, that we wouldn't affirm on an argument that's not raised by a respondent. I mean, if the state didn't file a brief, for example, and we spotted an issue of issue preservation, we could still decide the case on that, I'd assume.
Ultimately, I think that the court has, again, the authority to decide whether it finds that that issue is before it and wants to address it. I think that the issues raised in the district court are very similar to what we're raising here. There's maybe not, they don't use those specific cases, but the argument essentially is the same, is that the kidnapping and the deprivation of parental rights, one is the more general crime, one is the more specific. And in both arguments we raise under issues 1 and 2, that's essentially the arguments we're making before this court. I do want to move on to my second argument regarding the Craven and the Colvig cases. I think when this court looks at Colvig, there is not, and well, and actually in either case, there's not the intricate looking at the specific elements of the offense and determining if they match up perfectly. And I think that's the argument that the state is trying to make here. Colvig, there's no discussion or very little discussion about the similarities between the theft statute and the, I think at the time it was called like fraudulently obtaining welfare. And when you look at Colvig and you look at those two different statutes, the elements do not line up perfectly. They're not exact. I think the broader theme from both those cases is that the concern is that when you have a general crime and a specific crime, and when the legislature has shown some intention adopting that more specific crime. In Colvig, the legislature showed that it didn't essentially want people on welfare to be charged with felonies for theft, and then that's why they had this specific misdemeanor crime. And that in this case, it's very clear from the legislative history and the initial the original language and the statute that that they didn't want abductor parents being charged with more serious crimes as happened here based on the prosecutor's discretion. And so that the when this court looks at those cases and looks at the themes of those cases, the concern, again, is here is the state initially charging my client with deprivation of parental rights and then ratcheting up the potential sentences and penalties that he could receive for the kidnapping in addition to the lodging of the predatory offender registration requirement based on his conviction for charging the more serious offense. And that's the concern that this court should look at, and that's the similarity between my client's case and Craven and Kelvig.
But the state can do alternative charging, right?
And that's correct.
So at the charging phase, I don't understand why they can't charge both of these counts. I mean, essentially your argument is they couldn't charge kidnapping.
That is my argument, is that it doesn't meet probable cause and that they're not able to charge in the same way that a person after Craven couldn't be charged with the more serious offense based on the same conduct. They would have to be charged with the more specific offense unless the legislature went and changed the statute afterwards.
Well, how does the, let me get into the sort of factual of the complaint here. How does it factor in that the children were taken at the time that they were in the uncle's custody and care? So mom gave permission to the uncle to move the kids around. And then when they're in his care and custody at the time, with her permission, the kids were taken without his permission. And that can still be kidnapping if you're taking a kid where they're from daycare and you pull them out. So how would that factor into to our analysis here?
Well, I don't think that's the specific charge that he's charged with. I think he's charged with taking the children in violation of the order and not necessarily charged with specifically taking the children because they're in the custody of the uncle versus the mother. And I think, and again, that is used as the underlying felony for the kidnapping. There is nothing independent of the deprivation of parental rights that justifies the kidnapping charges here. And I think, again, that's why we come in under the guise of Kelvig and Craven, is that the concern is that, you know, you are essentially just as in Craven, the state dismissed the more specific charged the felony murder, and then used fleeing a police officer as the underlying felony. And that's very similar to what we have take place here. So I don't think that in the original charging decision, in this case and then going forward, that the state would be able to, under these specific facts, be able to just charge a kidnapping based on the underlying offense of deprivation of parental rights.
But the underlying order that says your client has visitation rights only is where it gets into the, does the father have permission at all to move these kids? But at the time that he did move these kids, my point is that it's in the custody and care of the uncle at that point in time. And there's no deprivation of parental rights when it comes to the uncle. And so why couldn't that be alternative charges on the same thing? I mean, the permission stems from mother to uncle to have the kids. Father doesn't have any rights to move the kids without beyond the visitation.
Well, again, I would just argue that, or I would reassert that here we don't have a situation where there is a charge for him for the taking of the kids from the uncle. He's just being charged with the specific. And I think when you look at the Colvin decision, you know, a lot of the analysis in that case, although that's on a separate issue, is the specific facts of that case and not getting into other hypotheticals that could have been in play in Colvin that weren't based on the specific facts. I also wanted to, under the second argument, or sorry, under my first argument in the issue under the Craven and Kelvig. In Craven, they specifically, in the more specific offense, there was also an exception like the state is relying on regarding the kidnapping, where they say that this statute should apply unless you're being charged with a murder offense. And that's specifically what the prosecutor did in Craven, is they charged a murder offense. And this court in Craven, let's see if I can find the specific language in the site. So in Craven, under at page 635 in the pinpoint site, it said the fleeing causing death statute contains a proviso that indicates that the statute only applies where the death does not constitute murder or manslaughter. So you would think that that would open up the door to the state raising it as a felony murder. It says this language states a broad preference for the more general provisions of the criminal code defining murder or manslaughter, but it does not manifest an intent that the general felony murder statute should prevail over the more specific fleeing causing of death statute. So they have specifically rejected an argument similar to what's raised by the state here. And I think that the overarching principle that's in the initial enactment of that statute and the specific legislature's talking about what they intended with that statute is would trump over any general reference to an exclusion under the kidnapping statute. Unless the court has additional questions, I would resign my final 20 seconds. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, you have an additional 5 minutes in addition to that. You lost the 20 seconds, but you get 5 minutes. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Andrew Jackala. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the state of Minnesota. At the heart of this case is the question of whether the charges for deprivation of parental rights and kidnapping can harmoniously coexist. And what appellant's counsel is glomming onto is the second portion, or the initial portion of the subdivision that's in play of the kidnapping statute, which makes an element of the case that the offender used the kidnapping to facilitate the commission of any felony or flight thereafter. So what we're focusing on here, according to the argument, is the facilitate the commission of a felony component of this subdivision. And what counsel has argued is that you can't use, the state cannot use the deprivation of parental rights charge to substantiate the felony that's under that provision of the subdivision.
Counsel, related to that issue, would you explain the state's position on the Smith case from 2003 and the Welch case from 2004 as to the independent crime aspect?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, the second
case. The Smith case and the Welch case?
The Smith case, I think, ultimately is what will guide this court in formulating a holding that's applicable not only to this case, but also to...
I'm sorry. I don't think the clock has started. Let's go to 14 minutes. Thank you. Sorry. You can proceed whenever you're ready.
Okay. I'm sorry. The Smith decision, Your Honor. In reviewing that case, I came across some language that I think is very important to what one of the primary issues is in this case. And the holding in the Smith case says that where the confinement or removal, the actus reus of the kidnapping offense, of the victim is completely incidental to the perpetration of a separate felony, it does not constitute kidnapping. And I think the holding in that case, that precise language, is where we strike the proper balance between the forever or never dichotomy that's been set up by counsel's argument. It's not as though we can ever have these two charges coexist, but the language that we have from Smith is what guides this court and what will guide district courts in making a determination at an omnibus proceeding whether or not the elements of the deprivation charge are swallowed up by the bringing of a kidnapping charge. So just to flesh that out a little bit more, in this case, the essential facts are that the appellant went to his daughter's school and took them away from the uncle and left with them for over the course of a week. Now, when we're looking at a probable cause inquiry here to determine whether or not the registration should stand, it's a rather low bar, and the court will decide whether there's a reasonable probability that an offense was committed. So if we look at the facts particular to this case, you've got an adult male who lures two girls away from their school with promises of a gift, takes them across state lines for over a week, and the girls aren't returned until the perpetrator is apprehended by law enforcement.
But isn't it the same confinement and removal as it would have been for deprivation?
Well, that's the other part of my argument. I don't necessarily think it is, but I think what the crucial part of this case is relates more to the flight component of the kidnapping statute. So we have whether the underlying act is used to facilitate the commission of a felony or a flight thereafter. So when we look at the second part of that subdivision, the flight, that's what we have that distinguishes this case from one where a clever prosecutor may just point to the kidnapper, to the deprivation statute and say, hey, we've got an underlying felony that we can attach to make a kidnapping charge. I personally don't think that's right. I don't think that that any time you have a felony deprivation of parental rights, it shouldn't automatically be become a kidnapping charge. And the Aladdin case highlights that point very clearly. The Aladdin case, this court said that it's a fact-dependent inquiry. We look at the facts of each case. And the court will recall that in the Aladdin case, we had a custody dispute. There's a preliminary order issued by a family court on a dissolution matter that said the mother was entitled to have physical and legal custody of the children. The father shows up one evening upset about the custody arrangement and perpetrates a vicious assault on the mother. After that assault is completed, he takes one of the children and locks them in a bedroom upstairs, threatening to harm the daughter and is essentially using her as a hostage. So what this court did is looked at the facts of that case and said, we have a hostage taken in the true sense of the word. And I think that's very important language because I think in this case we have flight in the true sense of that word. I mean, the appellant took his daughters not only away from their uncle, but took them out of the city, out of the state, to Chicago for a period of almost a week. That is flight. So if we're looking at that second portion of the applicable subdivision, we have, did the appellant facilitate the commission of a felony or flight thereafter?
Provide a circumstance where you wouldn't have a flight component. Are you saying it's because they cross state lines? Are you saying it's because of the distance?
Well, I think flight is a malleable term, and it's going to be dependent upon the facts of each case.
So why wouldn't it occur every time the child is a child is moved, not necessarily across state lines?
Well, I think that's a determination that district courts have to make at an omnibus hearing, at a probable cause challenge. And I think that the Aladdin decision and the Smith case both provide the amount of guidance that district courts need. Returning to the Smith decision that Your Honor raised, if you have a situation where the removal, Judge Ross, is, in Smith's language, completely incidental to the act of depriving a parent of their custodial rights, maybe they're sitting in a park and the parent says, come on, it's time to go. It removed the child from that situation. So under the broadest reading of the kidnapping statute, yeah, I suppose that a clever prosecutor could formulate a charge based on that. But if we look...
Isn't that the problem, though? I mean, there's no statutory definition of flight. So if the prosecutor could go back to that, just because you took him out of the house, put him in your car, drove a block, that's flight. So arguably, there's no distinction.
Well, and I think that's the argument that the appellant is making here. And my response to that is we have guidance in the case law that makes that possibility not probable.
Okay, you mentioned case law, and I did mention the State v. Welch case from 2004. Can you distinguish this?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't have the facts of the Welch case right off the top.
Welch, provided the Supreme Court concluded there was insufficient evidence to support a kidnapping conviction because the confinement that formed the basis of the kidnapping was the very force and coercion that supported a second-degree criminal sexual conduct.
Okay, charge. Yeah, I do recall that one. And I think on the facts of this case, it's distinguishable because, again, the critical factual piece that I see in this is the flight that wasn't part of the Welch case. And so it's not just the inquiry of whether or not the elements of the kidnapping charge have been met, but also we can look in this case and say there's this added component of flight, which under the statute is a separate basis to establish a formal kidnapping charge.
But when you remove, I'm going back to Judge Ross's question, but when you remove the child under deprivation, arguably, that's flight.
Arguably, it is. I will concede that. But I do believe that there is enough in the case law that will guide district courts. We look at Aladdin, and Aladdin says that the overarching policy is to avoid having a bona fide kidnapping go unpublished. District courts can look at that decision and say, yes, that's one of the standards, and is it a bona fide kidnapping for a parent to take his child from the park back to his house? I think more often than not, prosecutors are going to look at that situation and say, no, we can't establish the facts of this case.
That's the tough thing. I mean, so we're relying upon a prosecutor's decision to decide. I mean, help us with the rule of law. I'll assume that we agree with you and that this is going to be a published opinion, and we're going to say, we're going to distinguish removal from flight. What exactly is the language that we would use to make that distinction?
The distinction, I think, has to do with both geography and haste. If the child is removed from an area outside of their normal dwelling space, so that might be either the custodial parent's house or the non-custodial parent's house, that's one indication that flight has occurred. So just to expand on that, if a father takes the child beyond, the non-custodial parent takes the child beyond his or her own house or beyond the house of the custodial parent, say, goes to a hotel, there's some indication that that the non-custodial parent is trying to secrete the child, keep them away from a place where they might otherwise normally be found. Also, on the haste element that I mentioned, is what are the circumstances by which they're leaving? Is this a parent and child walking away, and the child says, you know what, Dad, I'd love to have a little bit more time with you. I know I'm supposed to go home to Mom, but let's hang out a little bit longer. And the father says, yeah, let's do it. You know what? To heck with Mom. We're going to spend a little more time together. Let's go catch a movie. There's no hasty flight at that point. And I think that between prosecutors and the district courts, we have enough guidance here that proper and just decisions can be made.
Well, help us to hone in on that guidance. What is the language that we would use to establish the rule of law that distinguishes removal from flight?
Well, again, I don't have the perfect language standing here at the podium, but I do think that the geography and haste that I mentioned are two important components. And I think also that in the Aladdin case...
Well, what does that mean, geography and haste? So, you said it's not the normal dwelling of the non-custodial parent or the one accused of kidnapping. That's so any other place?
If there is an indication that that the non-custodial parent is trying to hide the child from a place where they might normally be found, I think that's a very critical component of a flight.
So you take the child without consent of the custodial parent and you go to a movie and that's flight?
No, I don't believe so.
Well, they're not going to look for him in a movie theater.
Well, again, going to the second component of this theoretical holding is that look to the haste. Are they speeding off in an effort not to be detected, or are they hopping in their car to go catch a movie? And what it really comes down to is it's a fact-dependent inquiry. Just like turning back to the Aladdin case, there's no statutory definition for the term hostage-taking. But this court looked at that situation and said, hey, here there was a hostage-taking in the true sense of the word. There's a bona fide kidnapping here.
Do you think the legislature viewed non-custodial parents taking children without consent the same as hostages in terms of strangers kidnapping people? Isn't that why they created the deprivation statute, to separate it?
In one respect. I mean, we have this legislative history that talks about expediting law enforcement in investigations, inquiries. That is part of the legislative record. I don't think we get there because I think the statute is not necessarily ambiguous, and if we don't have an ambiguous statute, we don't look to the legislative history. But I'm down to my final 30 seconds, and I would just like to make one other point that does speak to the statutory language. There's a term in this statute that has not received any judicial treatment, has not been argued by the appellant here, or frankly, as I've seen in the case law, ever. And the term is facilitate, because that's a critically important term, I think, in this statutory subdivision. What does it mean to facilitate the commission of a felony? It's not enough that we just have a predicate felony that can be pointed to. I'm sorry, Judge Ross, I'm out of time. May I finish my thought?
Yes, please do.
It's not enough that we just have these coincidental felonies that you can point to, that a prosecutor can look at the deprivation and say, hey, if a parent takes a child, we're always going to have a predicate felony here. No, the statute says that it must facilitate the commission of a felony. And to facilitate is to make something easier. So when district courts are looking at this particular statutory subdivision, I think defense attorneys need to push hard at the omnibus stage and say, Your Honor, we can only have these two coexisting charges if the state is able to prove that the latter, the deprivation charge, was that the kidnapping offense facilitated that deprivation charge. And I think here we clearly have that, because the deprivation offense was committed when the child was taken. The kidnapping facilitated the deprivation by extending its terms. He took the child away so that they would have more time. They would be in Chicago, they would be wherever, secreted in a home in St. Paul, so that the deprivation would be extended. That made the deprivation easier to accomplish.
Thank you. I believe we had
one more question, if I may. Yes. It's the same question Judge Cleary asked your opposing counsel about the sentencing order. Did you read the sentencing order also as registered just for the duration of the probation?
My understanding of it was that it was a 10-year term.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that answer.
My understanding is that it was a 10-year term.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, rebuttal. And again, if you'll state your name as you begin.
Devee Axelson.
Thank you.
Reappearing in rebuttal. I'm going to jump right into the flight issue, which is on everybody's mind. And I think that the flight has to be looked in the context of it's not a separate component or subdivision. It follows for the purpose of facilitating the commission of any felony or flight thereafter. So I think it kind of is part and parcel. And I think this court kind of got to that point when you look at the Welch and the Smith decisions that you need something more than incidental to commit the felony. So in almost every, and I can't think of a scenario, I don't know that my colleague here provided a perfect example, but that the committing the deprivation of parental rights, taking the child, the flight is part and parcel of that, and it is, and it's going to be in almost every situation, but it needs to be looked at in the context of that subdivision. The other thing I would say is, you know, Aladdin, if this court, at least on the issue three, wants to say that the statutory construction in Aladdin is appropriate, the Aladdin decision doesn't play a role in the first or second issue because Aladdin doesn't involve the underlying felony of deprivation of parental rights. Aladdin committed different offenses that justified independent crimes separate from the deprivation of parental rights, and that's why I don't think Aladdin plays any role in this court's analysis on issue one or issue two. And I think Aladdin specifically says it's specific to its facts when it did reach its holding, even on the statutory construction argument. But the rule that we're asking for again is that that this court should hold that a defendant who's the parent of a child cannot be charged with a kidnapping when the only underlying felony offense is deprivation of parental rights, and there's no independent crime as there is in Aladdin, but there isn't present here. And again, the other last thing that I would say is that this court should rely on the amended complaint, the probable cause portion of that. That's when the motion was made for probable cause. It was denied at that point. What's brought up and during the trial is a separate thing, but the state had the opportunity in that amended complaint to make its strongest case for its argument, and there was and the part of the reason they filed that amended complaint is because the defense attorney asked, which felony are you alleging here? And the felony that they said they were alleging was the deprivation of parental rights. If they thought that they had additional charges they could make based on some of the things that came out at trial, they would have done so, and they didn't do so in this case. And when this court looks at the Colvin decision, Colvin is very specific to the exact facts of that case because it was a stipulated facts trial. And here, the decision on probable cause is specific to what was raised in that amended complaint and argued at the probable cause hearing. Unless the court has additional questions for me, I would cede the rest of my time. Thank you very much.
It does not appear so. Thank you. Thank you both for your argument and your briefing in the matter. Very helpful. We'll take the matter under advisement. It's submitted. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you both. Have a great afternoon. Thank you.